One is better than another. I will come back to this point. In addition, there are serious lacunae in German tax records, owing in large part to the country's turbulent history in the 20th century, so that it is difficult to be sure about certain developments or to make sharp comparisons with other countries. Prussia, Saxony, and most other German states imposed an income tax relatively early, between 1880 and 1890, but there were no national laws or tax records until after World War I. There were frequent breaks in the statistical record during the 1920s, and then the records for 1938 to 1950 are missing altogether, so it is impossible to study how the income distribution evolved during World War II and its immediate aftermath. This distinguishes Germany from other countries deeply involved in the conflict, especially Japan and France, whose tax administrations continued to compile statistics during the war years without interruption, as if nothing were amiss. If Germany was anything like these two countries, it is likely that the top centile's share of national income reached a nadir in 1945. The year in which German capital and income from capital were reduced to virtually nothing, before beginning to rise sharply again in 1946 to 1947. Yet when German tax records return in 1950, they show the income hierarchy already beginning to resemble its appearance in 1938. In the absence of complete sources, it is difficult to say more. The German case is further complicated by the fact that the country's boundaries changed several times during the 20th century, most recently with the reunification of 1990 to 1991, in addition to which full tax data are published only every 3 years, rather than annually, as in most other countries. Inequalities in emerging economies. Lower than in the United States? Let me turn now to the poor and emerging economies. The historical sources we need in order to study the long-run dynamics of the wealth distribution there are unfortunately harder to come by than in the rich countries. There are, however, a number of poor and emerging economies for which it is possible to find long series of tax data useful for making rough comparisons with our results for the more developed economies. Shortly after Britain introduced a progressive income tax at home, it decided to do the same in a number of its colonies. Thus, an income tax fairly similar to that introduced in Britain in 1909 was adopted in South Africa in 1913 and in India, including present-day Pakistan, in 1922. Similarly, the Netherlands imposed an income tax on its Indonesian colony in 1920. Several South American countries introduced an income tax between the two world wars. Argentina, for example, did so in 1932. For these four countries, South Africa, India, Indonesia, and Argentina, we have tax data going back, respectively, to 1913, 1922, 1920, and 1932, and continuing, with gaps, to the present. The data are similar to what we have for the rich countries, and can be employed using similar methods, in particular national income estimates for each country, going back to the turn of the 20th century. My estimates are indicated in PDF Figure 9.9. Several points deserve to be emphasized. First, the most striking result is probably that the upper centile's share of national income, in poor and emerging economies, is roughly the same as in the rich economies. During the most inegalitarian phases, especially 1910 to 1950, the top centile took around 20% of national income in all four countries, 15 to 18% in India, and 22 to 25% in South Africa, Indonesia, and Argentina. During more egalitarian phases, essentially 1950 to 1980, the top centile's share fell to between 6 and 12%, barely 5 to 6% in India, 8 to 9% in Indonesia and Argentina, and 11 to 12% in South Africa. Thereafter, in the 1980s, the top centile's share rebounded, and today it stands at about 15% of national income, 12 to 13% in India and Indonesia, and 16 to 18% in South Africa and Argentina. PDF Figure 9.9 also shows two countries for which the available tax records allow us only to study how things have changed since the mid-1980s, China and Colombia. In China, the top centile's share of national income rose rapidly over the past several decades, but starting from a fairly low, almost Scandinavian level in the mid-1980s, less than 5% of national income went to the top centile at that time, according to the available sources. This is not very surprising for a communist country with a very compressed wage schedule and virtual absence of private capital. Chinese inequality increased very rapidly following the liberalization of the economy in the 1980s and accelerated growth in the period 1990 to 2000. But according to my estimates, the upper centile's share in 2000 to 2010 was 10 to 11%, less than in India or Indonesia, 12 to 14%, roughly the same as Britain and Canada, and much lower than in South Africa or Argentina, 16 to 18%, approximately the same as the United States. Colombia, on the other hand, is one of the most inegalitarian societies in the WTID. The top centile's share stood at about 20% of national income throughout the period 1990 to 2010, with no clear trend. See PDF Figure 9.9. This level of inequality is even higher than that attained by the United States in 2000 to 2010, at least if capital gains are excluded. If they are included, the United States was slightly ahead of Colombia over the past decade. It is important, however, to be aware of the significant limitations of the data available for measuring the dynamics of the income distribution in poor and emerging countries, and for comparing them with the rich countries. The orders of magnitude indicated here are the best I was able to come up with, given the available sources. But the truth is that our knowledge remains meager. We have tax data for the entire 20th century for only a few emerging economies, and there are many gaps and breaks in the data, often in the period 1950 to 1970, the era of independence, in Indonesia, for example. Work is going forward to update the WTID with historical data from many other countries, especially from among the former British and French colonies, in Indochina and Africa. But data from the colonial era are often difficult to relate to contemporary tax records. Where tax records do exist, their interest is often reduced by the fact that the income tax in less developed countries generally applies to only a small minority of the population, so that one can estimate the upper centile's share of total income, but not the upper deciles. Where the data allow, as in South Africa for certain sub-periods, one finds that the highest observed levels for the top decile are on the order of 50 to 55% of national income, a level comparable to or slightly higher than the highest levels of inequality observed in the wealthy countries, in Europe in 1900 to 1910, and in the United States in 2000 to 2010. I have also noticed a certain deterioration of the tax data after 1990. This is due in part to the arrival of computerized records, which in many cases led the tax authorities to interrupt the publication of detailed statistics, which in earlier periods they needed for their own purposes. This sometimes means, paradoxically, that sources have deteriorated since the advent of the information age. We find the same thing happening in the rich countries. Above all, the deterioration of the sources seems to be related to a certain disaffection with the progressive income tax in general on the part of certain governments and international organizations. A case in point is India, which ceased publishing detailed income tax data in the early 2000s, even though such data had been published without interruption since 1922. As a result, it is harder to study the evolution of top incomes in India since 2000 than over the course of the 20th century. This lack of information and democratic transparency is all the more regrettable in that the question of the distribution of wealth and of the fruits of growth is at least as urgent in the poor and emerging economies as in the rich ones. Note, too, that the very high official growth figures for developing countries, especially India and China, over the past few decades, are based almost exclusively on production statistics. If one tries to measure income growth by using household survey data, it is often quite difficult to identify the reported rates of macroeconomic growth. Indian and Chinese incomes are certainly increasing rapidly, but not as rapidly as one would infer from official growth statistics. This paradox, sometimes referred to as the black hole of growth, is obviously problematic. It may be due to the overestimation of growth of output. There are many bureaucratic incentives for doing so. Or perhaps the underestimation of income growth. Household surveys have their own flaws, or most likely both. In particular, the missing income may be explained by the possibility that a disproportionate share of the growth in output has gone to the most highly remunerated individuals, whose incomes are not always captured in the tax data. In the case of India, it is possible to estimate, using tax return data, that the increase in the upper centile's share of national income explains between one-quarter and one-third of the black hole of growth between 1990 and 2000. Given the deterioration of the tax data since 2000, it is impossible to do a proper social decomposition of recent growth. In the case of China, official tax records are even more rudimentary than in India. In the current state of research, the estimates in PDF Figure 9.9 are the most reliable we have. It is nevertheless urgent that both countries publish more complete data, and other countries should do so as well. If and when better data become available, we may discover that inequality in India and China has increased more rapidly than we imagined. In any case, the important point is that whatever flaws the tax authorities in poor and emerging countries may exhibit, the tax data reveal much higher and more realistic top income levels than do household surveys. For example, tax returns show that the top centile's share of national income in Colombia in 2000 to 2010 was more than 20% and almost 20% in Argentina. Actual inequality may be even greater. But the fact that the highest incomes declared in household surveys in these same countries are generally only 4 to 5 times as high as the average income, suggesting that no one is really rich, so that if we were to trust the household survey, the top centile's share would be less than 5%, suggests that the survey data are not very credible. Clearly, household surveys, which are often the only source used by international organizations, in particular the World Bank, and governments for gauging inequality, give a biased and misleadingly complacent view of the distribution of wealth. As long as these official estimates of inequality fail to combine survey data with other data systematically gleaned from tax records and other government sources, it will be impossible to apportion macroeconomic growth properly among various social groups or among the centiles and deciles of the income hierarchy. This is true, moreover, of wealthy countries, as well as poor and emerging ones. The illusion of marginal productivity. Let me now return to the explosion of wage inequality in the United States, and to a lesser extent, Britain and Canada after 1970. As noted, the theory of marginal productivity and of the race between technology and education is not very convincing. The explosion of compensation has been highly concentrated in the top centile, or even the top thousandth, of the wage distribution, and has affected some countries while sparing others. Japan and continental Europe are thus far much less affected than the United States. Even though one would expect technological change to have altered the whole top end of the skill distribution in a more continuous way, and to have worked its effects in all countries at a similar level of development. The fact that income inequality in the United States in 2000 to 2010 attained a level higher than that observed in the poor and emerging countries at various times in the past, for example, higher than in India or South Africa in 1920 to 1930, 1960 to 1970, and 2000 to 2010, also casts doubt on any explanation based solely on objective inequalities of productivity. Is it really the case that inequality of individual skills and productivities is greater in the United States today than in the half-illiterate India of the recent past, or even today, or in apartheid or post-apartheid South Africa? If that were the case, it would be bad news for U.S. educational institutions, which surely need to be improved and made more accessible, but probably do not deserve such extravagant blame. To my mind, the most convincing explanation for the explosion of the very top U.S. incomes is the following. As noted, the vast majority of top earners are senior managers of large firms. It is rather naive to seek an objective basis for their high salaries in individual productivity. When a job is replicable, as in the case of an assembly line worker or fast food server, we can give an approximate estimate of the marginal product that would be realized by adding one additional worker or waiter, albeit with a considerable margin of error in our estimate. But when an individual's job functions are unique, or nearly so, then the margin of error is much greater. Indeed, once we introduce the hypothesis of imperfect information into standard economic models, eminently justifiable in this context, the very notion of individual marginal productivity becomes hard to define. In fact, it becomes something close to a pure ideological construct on the basis of which a justification for higher status can be elaborated. To put this discussion in more concrete terms, imagine a large multinational corporation employing 100,000 people and with gross annual revenue of 10 billion euros, or 100,000 euros per worker. Suppose that half of this revenue figure represents purchases of goods and services by the firm. This is a typical figure for the economy as a whole. So that the value added by the firm, the value available to pay the labor and capital that it directly employs, is 5 billion euros, or 50,000 euros per worker. To set the pay of the firm's CFO, or his deputies, or of the director of marketing and her staff, etc., one would, in principle, want to estimate his marginal productivity, that is, his contribution to the firm's value added of 5 billion euros. Is it 100,000? 500,000, or 5 million euros per year? A precise, objective answer to this question is clearly impossible. To be sure, one could in theory experiment by trying out several CFOs, each for several years, in order to determine what impact the choice has on the firm's total revenue of 10 billion euros. Obviously, such an estimate would be highly approximate, with a margin of error much greater than the maximum salary one would think of paying, even in a totally stable economic environment. And the whole idea of experimentation looks even more hopeless when one remembers that the environment is in fact changing constantly, as is the nature of the firm and the exact definition of each job. In view of these informational and cognitive difficulties, how are such remunerations determined in practice? They are generally set by hierarchical superiors, and at the very highest levels, salaries are set by the executives themselves, or by corporate compensation committees, whose members usually earn comparable salaries, such as senior executives of other large corporations. In some companies, stockholders are asked to vote on compensation for senior executives at annual meetings, but the number of posts subject to such approval is small, and not all senior managers are covered. Since it is impossible to give a precise estimate of each manager's contribution to the firm's output, it is inevitable that this process yields decisions that are largely arbitrary and dependent on hierarchical relationships and on the relative bargaining power of the individuals involved. It is only reasonable to assume that people in a position to set their own salaries have a natural incentive to treat themselves generously, or at the very least, to be rather optimistic in gauging their marginal productivity. To behave in this way is only human, especially since the necessary information is, in objective terms, highly imperfect. It may be excessive to accuse senior executives of having their hands in the till, but the metaphor is probably more apt than Adam Smith's metaphor of the market's invisible hand. In practice, the invisible hand does not exist, any more than pure and perfect competition does, and the market is always embodied in specific institutions, such as corporate hierarchies and compensation committees. This does not mean that senior executives and compensation committees can set whatever salaries they please and always choose the highest possible figure. Corporate governance is subject to certain institutions and rules specific to each country. The rules are generally ambiguous and flawed, but there are certain checks and balances. Each society also imposes certain social norms, which affect the views of senior managers and stockholders, or their proxies, who are often institutional investors, such as financial corporations and pension funds, as well as of the larger society. These social norms reflect beliefs about the contributions that different individuals make to the firm's output and to economic growth in general. Since uncertainty about these issues is great, it is hardly surprising that perceptions vary from country to country and period to period and are influenced by each country's specific history. The important point is that it is very difficult for any individual firm to go against the prevailing social norms of the country in which it operates. Without a theory of this kind, it seems to me quite difficult to explain the very large differences of executive pay that we observe between, on the one hand, the United States, and to a lesser extent in other English-speaking countries, and on the other, continental Europe and Japan. Simply put, wage inequalities increased rapidly in the United States and Britain because U.S. and British corporations became much more tolerant of extremely generous pay packages after 1970. Social norms evolved in a similar direction in European and Japanese firms, but the change came later in the 1980s or 1990s and has thus far not gone as far as in the United States. Executive compensation of several million euros a year is still more shocking today in Sweden, Germany, France, Japan, and Italy than in the United States or Britain. It has not always been this way. Far from it. Recall that in the 1950s and 1960s, the United States was more egalitarian than France, especially in regard to the wage hierarchy. But it has been this way since 1980. And all signs are that this change in senior management compensation has played a key role in the evolution of wage inequalities around the world. The takeoff of the supermanagers, a powerful force for divergence. This approach to executive compensation in terms of social norms and acceptability seems rather plausible a priori, but in fact it only shifts the difficulty to another level. The problem is now to explain where these social norms come from and how they evolve, which is obviously a question for sociology, psychology, cultural and political history, and the study of beliefs and perceptions at least as much as for economics per se. The problem of inequality is a problem for the social sciences in general, not for just one of its disciplines. In the case in point, I noted earlier that the conservative revolution that gripped the United States and Great Britain in the 1970s and 1980s, and that led to, among other things, greater tolerance of very high executive pay, was probably due in part to a feeling that these countries were being overtaken by others, even though the post-war period of high growth in Europe and Japan was in reality an almost mechanical consequence of the shocks of the period 1914 to 1945. Obviously, however, other factors also played an important role. To be clear, I am not claiming that all wage inequality is determined by social norms of fair remuneration. As noted, the theory of marginal productivity and of the race between technology and education offers a plausible explanation of the long-run evolution of the wage distribution, at least up to a certain level of pay and within a certain degree of precision. Technology and skills set limits within which most wages must be fixed. But to the extent that certain job functions, especially in the upper management of large firms, become more difficult to replicate, the margin of error in estimating the productivity of any given job becomes larger. The explanatory power of the skills technology logic then diminishes, and that of social norms increases. Only a small minority of employees are affected, a few percent at most, and probably less than 1%, depending on the country and period. But the key fact, which was by no means evident a priori, is that the top centile's share of total wages can vary considerably by country and period, as the disparate evolutions in the wealthy countries after 1980 demonstrate. The explosion of supermanager salaries should, of course, be seen in relation to firm size and to the growing diversity of functions within the firm. But the objectively complex problem of governance of large organizations is not the only issue. It is also possible that the explosion of top incomes can be explained as a form of meritocratic extremism, by which I mean the apparent need of modern societies, and especially U.S. society, to designate certain individuals as winners and to reward them all the more generously if they seem to have been selected on the basis of their intrinsic merits rather than birth or background. I will come back to this point. In any case, the extremely generous rewards meted out to top managers can be a powerful force for divergence of the wealth distribution. If the best-paid individuals set their own salaries, at least to some extent, the result may be greater and greater inequality. It is very difficult to say in advance where such a process might end. Consider again the case of the CFO of a large firm with gross revenue of 10 billion euros a year. It is hard to imagine that the Corporate Compensation Committee would suddenly decide that the CFO's marginal productivity is 1 billion or even 100 million euros, if only because it would then be difficult to find enough money to pay the rest of the management team. By contrast, some people might think that a pay package of 1 million, 10 million, or even 50 million euros a year would be justified. Uncertainty about individual marginal productivity being so large that no obvious limit is apparent. It is perfectly possible to imagine that the top centile's share of total wages could reach 15 to 20% in the United States, or 25 to 30%, or even higher. The most convincing proof of the failure of corporate governance and of the absence of a rational productivity justification for extremely high executive pay is that when we collect data about individual firms, which we can do for publicly owned corporations in all the rich countries, it is very difficult to explain the observed variations in terms of firm performance. If we look at various performance indicators, such as sales growth, profits, and so on, we can break down the observed variance as a sum of other variances. Variance due to causes external to the firm, such as the general state of the economy, raw material price shocks, variations in the exchange rate, average performance of other firms in the same sector, etc., plus other non-external variances. Only the latter can be significantly affected by the decisions of the firm's managers. If executive pay were determined by marginal productivity, one would expect its variance to have little to do with external variances and to depend solely or primarily on non-external variances. In fact, we observe just the opposite. It is when sales and profits increase for external reasons that executive pay rises almost rapidly. This is particularly clear in the case of U.S. corporations. Bertrand and Moulay-Nathan refer to this phenomenon as pay for luck. I return to this question and generalize this approach in Part 4. See Chapter 14. The propensity to pay for luck varies widely with country and period, and notably as a function of changes in tax laws, especially the top marginal income tax rate, which seems to serve either as a protective barrier when it is high, or an incentive to mischief when it is low, at least up to a certain point. Of course, changes in tax laws are themselves linked to changes in social norms pertaining to inequality, but once set in motion, they proceed according to a logic of their own. Specifically, the very large decrease in the top marginal income tax rate in the English-speaking countries after 1980, despite the fact that Britain and the United States had pioneered nearly confiscatory taxes on incomes deemed to be indecent in earlier decades, seems to have totally transformed the way top executive pay is set, since top executives now had much stronger incentives than in the past to seek large raises. I also analyze the way this amplifying mechanism can give rise to another force for divergence that is more political in nature. The decrease in the top marginal income tax rate led to an explosion of very high incomes, which then increased the political influence of the beneficiaries of the change in the tax laws, who had an interest in keeping top tax rates low, or even decreasing them further, and who could use their windfall to finance political parties, pressure groups, and think tanks. Chapter 10. Inequality of Capital Ownership. Let me turn now to the question of inequality of wealth and its historical evolution. The question is important, all the more so because the reduction of this type of inequality and of the income derived from it was the only reason why total income inequality diminished during the first half of the 20th century. As noted, inequality of income from labor did not decrease in a structural sense between 1900 to 1910 and 1950 to 1960 in either France or the United States, contrary to the optimistic predictions of Kuznets' theory, which was based on the idea of a gradual and mechanical shift of labor from worse-paid to better-paid types of work. And the sharp drop in total income inequality was due essentially to the collapse of high incomes from capital. All the information at our disposal indicates that the same is true for all the other developed countries. It is therefore essential to understand how and why this historic compression of inequality of wealth came about. The question is all the more important because capital ownership is apparently becoming increasingly concentrated once again today, as the capital income ratio rises and growth slows. The possibility of a widening wealth gap raises many questions as to its long-term consequences. In some respects, it is even more worrisome than the widening income gap between supermanagers and others, which to date remains a geographically limited phenomenon. Hyperconcentrated wealth, Europe and America. As noted in Chapter 7, the distribution of wealth, and therefore of income from capital, is always much more concentrated than the distribution of income from labor. In all known societies, at all times, the least wealthy half of the population own virtually nothing, generally little more than 5% of total wealth. The top decile of the wealth hierarchy own a clear majority of what there is to own, generally more than 60% of total wealth, and sometimes as much as 90%, and the remainder of the population, by construction, the 40% in the middle, own from 5 to 35% of all wealth. I also noted the emergence of a patrimonial middle class, that is, an intermediate group who are distinctly wealthier than the poorer half of the population and own between a quarter and a third of national wealth. The emergence of this middle class is no doubt the most important structural transformation to affect the wealth distribution over the long run. Why did this transformation occur? To answer this question, one must first take a closer look at the chronology. When and how did inequality of wealth begin to decline? To be candid, because the necessary sources, mainly probate records, are unfortunately not always available, I have thus far not been able to study the historical evolution of wealth inequality in as many countries as I examined in the case of income inequality. We have fairly complete historical estimates for four countries: France, Britain, the United States, and Sweden. The lessons of these four histories are fairly clear and consistent, however, so that we can say something about the similarities and differences between the European and U.S. trajectories. Furthermore, the wealth data have one enormous advantage over the income data. They allow us in some cases to go much farther back in time. Let me now examine one by one the four countries I have studied in detail. France, an observatory of private wealth. France is a particularly interesting case because it is the only country for which we have a truly homogeneous historical source that allows us to study the distribution of wealth continuously from the late 18th century to the present. In 1791, shortly after the fiscal privileges of the nobility were abolished, a tax on estates and gifts was established, together with a wealth registry. These were astonishing innovations at the time, notable for their universal scope. The new estate tax was universal in three ways. First, it applied to all types of property: farmland, other urban and rural real estate, cash, public and private bonds, other kinds of financial assets, such as shares of stock or partnerships, furniture, valuables, and so on. Second, it applied to all owners of wealth, whether noble or common. And third, it applied to fortunes of all sizes, large or small. Moreover, the purpose of this fundamental reform was not only to fill the coffers of the new regime, but also to enable the government to record all transfers of wealth, whether by bequest, at the owner's death, or gift, during the owner's lifetime, in order to guarantee to all the full exercise of their property rights. In official language, the estate and gift tax has always, from 1791 until now, been classified as one of a number of droits d'enregistrement, recording fees, and more specifically, droits de mutation, transfer fees, which included both charges assessed on free will transfers, or transfers of title to property made without financial consideration, by bequest or gift, and transfers for consideration, that is, transfers made in exchange for cash or other valuable tokens. The purpose of the law was thus to allow every property owner, large or small, to record his title and thus to enjoy his property rights in full security, including the right to appeal to the public authorities in case of difficulty. Thus, a fairly complete system of property records was established in the late 1790s and early 1800s, including a cadastre for real estate that still exists today. In Part 4, I say more about the history of estate taxes in different countries. At this stage, taxes are of interest primarily as a historical source. In most other countries, it was not until the end of the 19th century, or beginning of the 20th, that estate and gift taxes comparable to France's were established. In Britain, the reform of 1894 unified previous taxes on the conveyance of real estate, financial assets, and personal estate. But homogeneous probate statistics covering all types of property go back only to 1919 to 1920. In the United States, the federal tax on estates and gifts was not created until 1916 and covered only a tiny minority of the population. Although taxes covering broader segments of the population do exist in some states, these are highly heterogeneous. Hence, it is very difficult to study the evolution of wealth inequalities in these two countries before World War I. To be sure, there are many probate documents and estate inventories, mostly of private origin, dealing with particular subsets of the population and types of property. But there is no obvious way to use these records to draw general conclusions. This is unfortunate because World War I was a major shock to wealth and its distribution. One of the primary reasons for studying the French case is precisely that it will allow us to place this crucial turning point in a longer historical perspective. From 1791 to 1901, the estate and gift tax was strictly proportional. It varied with degree of kinship, but was the same regardless of the amount transferred, and was usually quite low, generally 1 to 2%. The tax was made slightly progressive in 1901 after a lengthy parliamentary battle. The government, which had begun publishing detailed statistics on the annual flow of bequests and donations as far back as the 1820s, began compiling a variety of statistics by size of estate in 1901. And from then until the 1950s, these became increasingly sophisticated, with cross-tabulations by age, size of estate, type of property, etc. After 1970, digital files containing representative samples from estate and gift tax filings in a specific year became available, so that the data set can be extended to 2000 to 2010. In addition to the rich sources produced directly by the tax authorities over the past two centuries, I have also collected, together with Postel-Vinet and Rosenthal, tens of thousands of individual declarations, which have been very carefully preserved in national and departmental archives since the early 19th century, for the purpose of constructing large samples covering each decade, from 1800 to 1810, to 2000 to 2010. All in all, French probate records offer an exceptionally rich and detailed view of two centuries of wealth accumulation and distribution. The Metamorphoses of a Patrimonial Society. PDF Figure 10.1 presents the main results I obtained for the evolution of the wealth distribution from 1810 to 2010. The first conclusion is that prior to the shocks of 1914 to 1945, there was no visible trend toward reduced inequality of capital ownership. Indeed, there was a slight tendency for capital concentration to rise throughout the 19th century, starting from an already very high level, and even an acceleration of the inegalitarian spiral in the period 1880 to 1913. The top decile of the wealth hierarchy already owned between 80 and 85% of all wealth at the beginning of the 19th century. By the turn of the 20th, it owned nearly 90%. The top centile alone owned 45 to 50% of the nation's wealth in 1800 to 1810. Its share surpassed 50% in 1850 to 1860 and reached 60% in 1900 to 1910. Looking at these data with the historical distance we enjoy today, we cannot help being struck by the impressive concentration of wealth in France during the Belle Époque, notwithstanding the reassuring rhetoric of the Third Republic's economic and political elites. In Paris, which was home to little more than 1/20th of the population in 1900 to 1910, but claimed 1/4 of the wealth, the concentration of wealth was greater still, and seems to have increased without limit during the decades leading up to World War I. In the capital, where in the 19th century 2/3 of the population died without any wealth to leave to the next generation, compared with half of the population in the rest of the country, but where the largest fortunes were also concentrated, the top centile's share was about 55% at the beginning of the century, rose to 60% in 1880 to 1890, and then to 70% on the eve of World War I. See PDF Figure 10.2. Looking at this curve, it is natural to ask how high the concentration of wealth might have gone had there been no war. The probate records also allow us to see that throughout the 19th century, wealth was almost as unequally distributed within each age cohort as in the nation as a whole. Note that the estimates indicated in PDF figures 10.1 to 2 and subsequent figures reflect inequality of wealth in the living adult population at each charted date. We start with wealth at the time of death, but reweight each observation as a function of the number of living individuals in each age cohort as of the date in question. In practice, this does not make much difference. The concentration of wealth among the living is barely a few points higher than inequality of wealth at death, and the temporal evolution is nearly identical in each case. How concentrated was wealth in France during the 18th century, up to the eve of the Revolution? Without a source comparable to the probate records created by the revolutionary assemblies, for the Ancien Régime we have only heterogeneous and incomplete sets of private data, as for Britain and the United States until the late 19th century, it is unfortunately impossible to make precise comparisons. Yet all signs are that inequality of private wealth decreased slightly between 1780 and 1810, owing to redistribution of agricultural land and cancellation of public debt during the Revolution, together with other shocks to aristocratic fortunes. It is possible that the top decile's share attained or even slightly exceeded 90% of total wealth on the eve of 1789, and that the upper centile's share attained or exceeded 60%. Conversely, the émigré billion, the billion francs paid to the nobility in compensation for land confiscated during the Revolution, and the return of the nobility to the forefront of the political scene, contributed to the reconstitution of some old fortunes during the period of limited suffrage monarchy, 1815 to 1848. In fact, our probate data reveal that the percentage of aristocratic names in the top centile of the Parisian wealth hierarchy increased gradually from barely 15% in 1800 to 1810 to nearly 30% in 1840 to 1850, before embarking on an inexorable decline from 1850 to 1860 on, falling to less than 10% by 1890 to 1900. The magnitude of the changes initiated by the French Revolution should not be overstated, however. Beyond the probable decrease of inequality of wealth between 1780 and 1810, followed by a gradual increase between 1810 and 1910, and especially after 1870, the most significant fact is that inequality of capital ownership remained relatively stable at an extremely high level throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. During this period, the top decile consistently owned 80 to 90% of total wealth, and the top centile, 50 to 60%. As I showed in Part 2, the structure of capital was totally transformed between the 18th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Landed capital was almost entirely replaced by industrial and financial capital and real estate. But total wealth, measured in years of national income, remained relatively stable. In particular, the French Revolution had relatively little effect on the capital-income ratio. As just shown, the Revolution also had relatively little effect on the distribution of wealth. In 1810 to 1820, the epoch of Père Goriot, Rastignac, and Mademoiselle Victorine, wealth was probably slightly less unequally distributed than during the Ancien Régime. But the difference was really rather minimal. Both before and after the Revolution, France was a patrimonial society characterized by a hyper-concentration of capital, in which inheritance and marriage played a key role, and inheriting or marrying a large fortune could procure a level of comfort not obtainable through work or study. In the Belle Époque, wealth was even more concentrated than when Vautrin lectured Rastignac. At bottom, however, France remained the same society, with the same basic structure of inequality from the Ancien Régime to the Third Republic, despite the vast economic and political changes that took place in the interim. Probate records also enable us to observe that the decrease in the upper decile's share of national wealth in the 20th century benefited the middle 40% of the population exclusively, while the share of the poorest 50% hardly increased at all. It remained less than 5% of total wealth. Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, the bottom half of the population had virtually zero net wealth. In particular, we find that at the time of death, individuals in the poorest half of the wealth distribution owned no real estate or financial assets that could be passed on to heirs, and what little wealth they had went entirely to expenses linked to death and to paying off debts, in which case the heirs generally chose to renounce their inheritance. The proportion of individuals in this situation at the time of death exceeded two-thirds in Paris throughout the 19th century and until the eve of World War I, and there was no downward trend. Père Goriot belonged to this vast group, dying, as he did, abandoned by his daughters and in abject poverty. His landlady, Madame Vauquet, dunned Rastignac for what the old man owed her, and he also had to pay the cost of burial, which exceeded the value of the deceased's meager personal effects. Roughly half of all French people in the 19th century died in similar circumstances, without any wealth to convey to heirs, or with only negative net wealth, and this proportion barely budged in the 20th century. Inequality of capital in Belle Époque Europe. The available data for other European countries, though imperfect, unambiguously demonstrate that extreme concentration of wealth in the 18th and 19th centuries, and until the eve of World War I, was a European, and not just a French phenomenon. In Britain, we have detailed probate data from 1910 to 1920 on, and these records have been exhaustively studied by many investigators, most notably Atkinson and Harrison. If we complete these statistics with estimates from recent years as well as the more robust but less homogeneous estimates that Peter Linder has made for the period 1810 to 1870, based on samples of estate inventories, we find that the overall evolution was very similar to the French case, although the level of inequality was always somewhat greater in Britain. The top decile's share of total wealth was on the order of 85% from 1810 to 1870, and surpassed 90% in 1900 to 1910. The uppermost centile's share rose from 55 to 60% in 1810 to 1870 to nearly 70% in 1910 to 1920. See PDF figure 10.3. The British sources are imperfect, especially for the 19th century, but the orders of magnitude are quite clear. Wealth in Britain was extremely concentrated in the 19th century and showed no tendency to decrease before 1914. From a French perspective, the most striking fact is that inequality of capital ownership was only slightly greater in Britain than in France during the Belle Époque, even though Third Republic elites at the time liked to portray France as an egalitarian country compared with its monarchical neighbor across the Channel. In fact, the formal nature of the political regime clearly had very little influence on the distribution of wealth in the two countries. In Sweden, where the very rich data available from 1910, of which Olsson, Royn, and Waldenström have recently made use, and for which we also have estimates for the period 1810 to 1870, by Lee Solto in particular, we find a trajectory very similar to what we observed in France and Britain. See PDF figure 10.4. Indeed, the Swedish wealth data confirm what we already know from income statements. Sweden was not the structurally egalitarian country that we sometimes imagine. To be sure, the concentration of wealth in Sweden in 1970 to 1980 attained the lowest level of inequality observed in any of our historical series, with barely 50% of total wealth owned by the top decile and slightly more than 15% by the top centile. This is still a fairly high level of inequality, however, and what is more, inequality in Sweden has increased significantly since 1980 to 1990, and in 2010 was just slightly lower than in France. It is worth stressing, moreover, that Swedish wealth was as concentrated as French and British wealth in 1900 to 1910. In the Belle Époque, wealth was highly concentrated in all European countries. It is essential to understand why this was so and why things changed so much over the course of the 20th century. Note, moreover, that we also find the same extremely high concentration of wealth, with 80 to 90% of capital owned by the top decile and 50 to 60% by the top centile in most societies prior to the 19th century, and in particular in traditional agrarian societies in the modern era, as well as in the Middle Ages and antiquity. The available sources are not sufficiently robust to permit precise comparisons or study temporal evolutions, but the orders of magnitude obtained for the shares of the top decile and centile in total wealth, and especially in total farmland, are generally close to what we find in France, Britain, and Sweden in the 19th century and Belle Époque. The emergence of the patrimonial middle class. Three questions will concern us in the remainder of this chapter. Why were inequalities of wealth so extreme and increasing before World War I? And why, despite the fact that wealth is once again prospering at the beginning of the 21st century, as it did at the beginning of the 20th century, as the evolution of the capital-income ratio shows, is the concentration of wealth today significantly below its historical record high? Finally, is this state of affairs irreversible? In fact, the second conclusion that emerges very clearly from the French data presented in PDF Figure 10.1 is that the concentration of wealth, as well as the concentration of income from wealth, has never fully recovered from the shocks of 1914 to 1945. The upper decile's share of total wealth, which attained 90% in 1910 to 1920, fell to 60 to 70% in 1950 to 1970. The upper centile's share dropped even more precipitously, from 60% in 1910 to 1920 to 20 to 30% in 1950 to 1970. Compared with the trend prior to World War I, the break is clear and overwhelming. To be sure, inequality of wealth began to increase again in 1980 to 1990, and financial globalization has made it more and more difficult to measure wealth and its distribution in a national framework. Inequality of wealth in the 21st century will have to be gauged more and more at the global level. Despite these uncertainties, however, there is no doubt that inequality of wealth today stands significantly below its level of a century ago. The top decile's share is now around 60 to 65%, which, though still quite high, is markedly below the level attained in the Belle Époque. The essential difference is that there is now a patrimonial middle class, which owns about a third of national wealth, a not insignificant amount. The available data for the other European countries confirm that this has been a general phenomenon. In Britain, the upper decile's share fell from more than 90% on the eve of World War I to 60 to 65% in the 1970s. It is currently around 70%. The top centile's share collapsed in the wake of the 20th century's shocks, falling from nearly 70% in 1910 to 1920 to barely more than 20% in 1970 to 1980, then rising 25 to 30% today. See PDF Figure 10.3. In Sweden, capital ownership was always less concentrated than in Britain, but the overall trajectory is fairly similar. See PDF Figure 10.4. In every case, we find that what the wealthiest 10% lost mainly benefited the patrimonial middle class, defined as the middle 40% of the wealth hierarchy, and did not go to the poorest half of the population, whose share of total wealth has always been minuscule, generally around 5%, even in Sweden, where it was never more than 10%. In some cases, such as Britain, we find that what the richest 1% lost also brought significant gains to the next lower 9%. Apart from such national specificities, however, the general similarity of the various European trajectories is quite striking. The major structural transformation was the emergence of a middle group representing nearly half the population, consisting of individuals who managed to acquire some capital of their own, enough so that collectively they came to own one quarter to one third of the nation's total wealth. Inequality of wealth in America. I turn now to the U.S. case. Here, too, we have probate statistics from 1910 to 1920 on, and these have been heavily exploited by researchers, especially Lampman, Kopchuk, and Saez. To be sure, there are important caveats associated with the use of these data, owing to the small percentage of the population covered by the federal estate tax. Nevertheless, estimates based on the probate data can be supplemented by information from the detailed wealth surveys that the Federal Reserve Bank has conducted since the 1960s, used notably by Arthur Kennekel and Edward Wolfe, and by less robust estimates for the period 1810 to 1870 based on estate inventories and wealth census data exploited respectively by Alice Hansen Jones and Lee Solto. Several important differences between the European and U.S. trajectories stand out. First, it appears that inequality of wealth in the United States around 1800 was not much higher than in Sweden in 1970 to 1980. Since the United States was a new country whose population consisted largely of immigrants who came to the New World with little or no wealth, this is not very surprising. Not enough time had passed for wealth to be accumulated or concentrated. The data nevertheless leave much to be desired, and there is some variation between the northern states, where estimates suggest a level of inequality lower than that of Sweden in 1970 to 1980, and southern states, where inequality was closer to contemporary European levels. It is a well-established fact that wealth in the United States became increasingly concentrated over the course of the 19th century. In 1910, capital inequality there was very high, though still markedly lower than in Europe. The top decile owned about 80% of total wealth, and the top centile around 45%. See PDF Figure 10.5. Interestingly, the fact that inequality in the New World seemed to be catching up with inequality in Old Europe greatly worried U.S. economists at the time. Wilford King's book on the distribution of wealth in the United States in 1915, the first broad study of the question, is particularly illuminating in this regard. From today's perspective, this may seem surprising. We have been accustomed for several decades now to the fact that the United States is more inegalitarian than Europe, and even that many Americans are proud of the fact, often arguing that inequality is a prerequisite of entrepreneurial dynamism and decrying Europe as a sanctuary of Soviet-style egalitarianism. A century ago, however, both the perception and the reality were strictly the opposite. It was obvious to everyone that the New World was by nature less inegalitarian than Old Europe, and this difference was also a subject of pride. In the late 19th century, in the period known as the Gilded Age, when some U.S. industrialists and financiers, for example John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, and J.P. Morgan, accumulated unprecedented wealth, many U.S. observers were alarmed by the thought that the country was losing its pioneering egalitarian spirit. To be sure, that spirit was partly a myth, but it was also partly justified by comparison with the concentration of wealth in Europe. In Part 4, we will see that this fear of growing to resemble Europe was part of the reason why the United States, in 1910 to 1920, pioneered a very progressive estate tax on large fortunes, which were deemed to be incompatible with U.S. values, as well as a progressive income tax on incomes thought to be excessive. Perceptions of inequality, redistribution, and national identity changed a great deal over the course of the 20th century, to put it mildly. Inequality of wealth in the United States decreased between 1910 and 1950, just as inequality of income did, but much less so than in Europe. Of course, it started from a lower level, and the shocks of war were less violent. By 2010, the top decile's share of total wealth exceeded 70%, and the top centile's share was close to 35%. In the end, the deconcentration of wealth in the United States over the course of the 20th century was fairly limited. The top decile's share of total wealth dropped from 80 to 70%, whereas in Europe it fell from 90 to 60%. See PDF Figure 10.6. The differences between the European and U.S. experiences are clear. In Europe, the 20th century witnessed a total transformation of society. Inequality of wealth, which on the eve of World War I was as great as it had been under the Ancien Régime, fell to an unprecedentedly low level, so low that nearly half the population were able to acquire some measure of wealth, and for the first time to own a significant share of national capital. This is part of the explanation for the great wave of enthusiasm that swept over Europe in the period 1945 to 1975. People felt that capitalism had been overcome and that inequality and class society had been relegated to the past. It also explains why Europeans had a hard time accepting that this seemingly ineluctable social progress ground to a halt after 1980. And why they are still wondering when the evil genie of capitalism will be put back in its bottle. In the United States, perceptions are very different. In a sense, a white, patrimonial middle class already existed in the 19th century. It suffered a setback during the Gilded Age, regained its health in the middle of the 20th century, and then suffered another setback after 1980. This yo-yo pattern is reflected in the history of U.S. taxation. In the United States, the 20th century is not synonymous with a great leap forward in social justice. Indeed, inequality of wealth there is greater today than it was at the beginning of the 19th century. Hence, the lost U.S. paradise is associated with the country's beginnings. There is nostalgia for the era of the Boston Tea Party, not for Trente Glorieuses and a heyday of state intervention to curb the excesses of capitalism. The mechanism of wealth divergence. R versus G in history. Let me try now to explain the observed facts. The hyper-concentration of wealth in Europe during the 19th century and up to World War I, the substantial compression of wealth inequality following the shocks of 1914 to 1945, and the fact that the concentration of wealth has not, thus far, regained the record heights set in Europe in the past. Several mechanisms may be at work here, and to my knowledge there is no evidence that would allow us to determine the precise share of each in the overall movement. We can, however, try to hierarchize the different mechanisms with the help of the available data and analyses. Here is the main conclusion that I believe we can draw from what we know. The primary reason for the hyper-concentration of wealth in traditional agrarian societies, and to a large extent in all societies prior to World War I, with the exception of the pioneer societies of the New World, which are for obvious reasons very special and not representative of the rest of the world or the long run, is that these were low-growth societies in which the rate of return on capital was markedly and durably higher than the rate of growth. This fundamental force for divergence, which I discussed briefly in the introduction, functions as follows. Consider a world of low growth, on the order of, say, 0.5 to 1% a year, which was the case everywhere before the 18th and 19th centuries. The rate of return on capital, which is generally on the order of 4 or 5% a year, is therefore much higher than the growth rate. Concretely, this means that wealth accumulated in the past is recapitalized much more quickly than the economy grows, even when there is no income from labor. For example, if G equals 1% and R equals 5%, saving one-fifth of the income from capital, while consuming the other four-fifths, is enough to ensure that capital inherited from the previous generation grows at the same rate as the economy. If one saves more, because one's fortune is large enough to live well while consuming somewhat less of one's annual rent, then one's fortune will increase more rapidly than the economy, and inequality of wealth will tend to increase, even if one contributes no income from labor. For strictly mathematical reasons, then, the conditions are ideal for an inheritance society to prosper, whereby inheritance society, I mean a society characterized by both a very high concentration of wealth and a significant persistence of large fortunes, from generation to generation. Now, it so happens that these conditions existed in any number of societies throughout history, and in particular in the